This is a CBC podcast.
For some, music isn't just a way to make a living. It's a way to make sense of the world. Where does inspiration come from? Join Patty Schmidt and go inside the music. Sundays at noon Eastern on CBC Radio 2.
From the Stephen Leacock Theatre in Keswick, Ontario, it's The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you. So here we are in Leacock country. And I was in Sutton the other afternoon walking along the hedge road, that evocatively narrow and twisty road that runs along Lake Simcoe's south shore. And I was pretending, as I always do when I walk along it, that I was walking through the British countryside, an easy trick to play on yourself around Jackson's Point, when I happened upon Canadian broadcaster Peter Zosky's old cottage, where I spent so many happy New Year's Eves, and which I feel compelled to report has been painted a surprising mauve since he sold it. Someone's also clear-cut the place. Well, no, that's an exaggeration. But they have cut down Zosky's favorite, and don't think the old tobacco bum wouldn't appreciate the irony, smoke tree. I can't help but wonder if they've also replaced the infamous burnt floorboard, charred the day a log rolled out of the fireplace onto the living room floor, while Zosky continued to sit at his desk, writing like a maniac. The log smoldered, Zosky typed, and the cottage eventually filled with smoke, and would no doubt have burnt to the ground had Peter Sybil Brown not happened on the scene, to find Zosky, whose back was to the fireplace, hacking away. It had not dawned on him that anything other than his chain of cigarettes might have caused the eye-stinging smoke hanging in the air around him. His only response had been to crack open the window. I wasn't there, however, to inspect or pass judgment on Zosky's old cottage. Time marches wearily on, and so did I. Along the hedge road, past the Briars, past Zosky's, and over the one lane only built in 1912 and historically designated iron bridge that spans the Black River. I was heading, coincidentally, to Peter Sybil Brown's house and studio to visit the man who plucked the log off the floor that smoky afternoon so long ago and whose wit and charm saved the day for Zosky so many other times over the years. I was going to see PSB, as Zosky affectionately dubbed him, partly because there are few people in this world who can make me laugh quite as joyfully as he does. And there I was in the neighborhood, and why would you miss a chance for a laugh? But only partly for the laughs. Mostly because I had, over lunch that day, learned that Peter Sybil Brown, who's an award-winning and elegant designer and collector of books, happened to be working with six or seven handwritten original pages of Stephen Leacock's manuscript from Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town. Leacock, as you no doubt know, is Canada's answer to Mark Twain. He was the most famous humorist in the world in the early days of the last century. Leacock, that is, not Twain. Twain was dead by 1910. In fact, it has been famously said that in his prime, more people had heard of Leacock than had heard of Canada. Sunshine Sketches is Leacock's enduring Canadian masterpiece. It was published in 1912, almost 100 years ago, and it still sells several thousand copies a year in the New Canadian Library edition. So I made my way over the bridge and past the little church where Leacock is buried, for this is Leacock country. He grew up and summered here on the shores of Lake Simcoe, and he knew all the little towns around and about. When I finally got to PSB's house, I found the manuscript on his work table, an unlined piece of brown paper which I reached out to touch in awe. As far as Canadian letters are concerned, the piece of paper that was lying in front of me was just about the fountainhead. Leacock, it turns out, wrote with a straight pen. You can see where the ink is faint, the exact places where he had run out. You can tell when it darkens where he paused and dipped, although it didn't look like there was a lot of pausing going on. "Yes," said PSB, smiling at me. "It looks like he was really galloping along, doesn't it?" PSB has studied the entire manuscript. "There are very few revisions anywhere," he said. We stood there marveling over the single page for a good 30 minutes, trying our best to wring some meaning out of it. And then I went back to my hotel room in some sort of dreamy state, feeling both connected to the past and wistful about it. What would I ask Leacock, I wonder, if he was alive today? What would I want to tell him? When I finally got back to my room, I pulled out the copy of Sunshine Sketches that I'd brought with me, and I spent the rest of that evening dipping into the elegance of Leacock's prose. Listen to this from Chapter 3, The Marine Excursion of the Knights of Pythias, a story from Sunshine Sketches that recounts the sinking of the paddle wheeler, the Mariposa Belle. And I place "sinking" in quotations because, well, I'm not going to recount the whole episode wherein the sinking ship ends up floating and then rescuing the sinking rescue boats. But consider this lovely moment. From the start, when the townsfolk from Mariposa are climbing aboard for the excursion that Leacock has explained will be totally dry, except, of course, for the 2 kegs of beer, which don't count. Dry because the Knights of Pythias are, of course, by their very constitution, dedicated to temperance. And there's Henry Mullins, I'm quoting Leacock now, the manager of the Exchange Bank, carrying a small flask in his hip pocket as a sort of, and here is Leacock's brilliant flourish, carrying a small flask in his hip pocket as a sort of amendment to the Constitution. That is why people still want to read Leacock. Mind you, many of the citizens of Orillia who felt that they were being lampooned when the book arrived didn't, but they just didn't get it. Didn't understand that affection and kindness were the cornerstones of Leacock's house of humor. His eye was focused through the sardonic lens of irony, not sarcasm or satire. And when he wrote of the town of Sutton, where I am staying this week, that it was an orderly little place, dull as ditch water, but quite unaware of the fact. When he wrote that, you have to remember he chose to be buried in Sutton. And you have to appreciate that the telling phrase isn't that it was dull, but that it had the redeeming quality of being unaware of the fact. Leacock, who could sound disparaging, believed deeply that humor should be, more than anything, kind, that one should laugh with and not at others. The provincial in me would like to think that this was his Canadian upbringing revealing itself, but if I was honest, I would have to acknowledge it's what you see in the best of Twain, who Leacock admired so much. And if you're so inclined, you can follow the thread of kindness as it weaves together all the great American and Canadian humorists who have written since, or the ones I think are great anyway. My hero, E.B. White, for one, who as well as Charlotte's Web wrote many humorous pieces for the New Yorker magazine and then, achingly, warned that you should avoid humor if you're concerned for your reputation as a writer. "The world likes humor," wrote White, "but treats it patronizingly, decorating its serious artists with laurel and its wags with Brussels sprouts." Writers who take their literary selves with great seriousness, says White in his essay about humor, are at considerable pains never to associate their names with anything funny. And yet, no less a serious person than that cagey old constitutional expert Eugene Forsey said of Stephen Leacock, who held a PhD from the University of Chicago, that he could have been anything he wanted, including Prime Minister of Canada. And Leacock? Leacock, who had an abiding interest in politics, said he would rather have written Alice in Wonderland than the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. And even poor old E.B. White, who mostly wrote kind and funny, and never thought of himself as a success because of it, knew that there is a fine line between laughing and crying. And when it's done right, that a piece of humor writing can bring a person to the point where his or her emotional responses are untrustworthy, to that place where tears and laughter meet. Humor can do that, wrote White, because it plays close to the big, hot fire, which is truth. Sometimes the reader feels the heat. I stayed up much later than I expected that night, looking for the heat in Leacock and finding plenty. And thinking of E.B. White, who I admire so much, and Mordecai Richler, who allowed me to audit his class at Sir George Williams University one winter long ago, and W.O. Mitchell, who graced me with friendship when I was beginning to write, and showed me by his own joyful example that it's permissible to rejoice in one's own work when you read it out loud. Leacock, I'm told, didn't work out when they put him on CBC Radio because of his habit of chuckling at his own jokes before delivering them. Mitchell, White, and Richler were all Leacock's children in a way, and all of them are gone now. Finally, I went to sleep with a sort of melancholy sadness that only comes with a really funny story. PSB woke me the next morning. "I forgot to tell you the most astonishing thing," he said over the telephone. "When Henry Fox Talbot was inventing photography, he didn't call it photography, and he didn't call pictures photographs. You know what he called them? They were using the natural light of the sun to take them. He called them sunshine sketches." Isn't that astonishing? So that was what Leacock was up to. And Twain before him, and Richler, and Mitchell, and the rest who have come and gone since, taking pictures. "I throw ink at the wolf to keep it from the door," said Leacock once, trying to explain his job as a writer. The thing about it is, he kept hitting the wolf, but softly, and with such affectionate and kind contemplation on the incongruities of life. God bless him. We were lucky he passed our way. Lucky still, because mercifully, whenever we want, we can still, with a flip of a page and God's good grace, feel his heat. Thank you. It's my pleasure now to introduce today's musical guest. This is Serena Ryder with a song from another great Canadian writer. This is Serena Ryder with Leonard Cohen's Sisters of Mercy.
The sea. sisters of mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on. And they brought me their comfort, and later they brought me this song. Oh, I hope you run into them, you who've been traveling so long. Yes, you must leave everything that you cannot control. With your family, soon it comes round to your soul. Well, I've been where you're hanging, I think I can see how you're pinned. When you're not feeling holy, your loneliness says that you've sinned. To them, they touched both my eyes, and I touched the dew on their hem. If your life is a leaf that the seasons tear off and condemn, they will bind you with love that is graceful and green as a stem. When I left, they were sleeping. I hope you run into them soon. Don't turn on the lights, you can read their address by the moon. And you won't make me jealous if I hear that they sweetened your night. We weren't lovers like that, and besides, it would still be all right. We weren't lovers like that, and besides, it would still be all right.
That was Serena Ryder. And that's from the album, If Your Memory Serves You Well. So it's time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. You know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories and they have to be short stories, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us. We promise we'll read some of our favorites on the radio. I have one today that comes from Mark Cross of Edmonton, Alberta. Dear Stuart, writes Mark, this tale begins 4 years ago when I met Anita. Initially, we discussed our likes and dislikes together, and we came to the conclusion that we would take up ballroom dancing. One of the fundamental problems that a potential ballroom dancer must face is finding a willing partner. And that's why I had never tried dancing before. The same was true for Anita, so she signed us up for classes on Thursday nights at a local college. The lessons, as it turned out, were twofold: the basics of ballroom dancing and the basics of communicating with each other. Our instructors, Lee and Blair, taught Anita and me several dances, the cha-cha, the rumba, the swing, the foxtrot, the waltz, and the tango, while all the while stressing to us the need to practice these steps on our own. So, we danced. Over many Saturday evenings, we danced in Anita's kitchen and worked out the steps together. And by worked out, I mean we practiced and fought over the steps as we struggled our way towards getting them just right. There are few ways to get to know someone better than dancing. We discovered that Anita verbally counts out the steps to the dances, and I intuitively feel my way through the beats. Many times I'd wait, arms crossed and tapping my toe, while Anita counted out the steps. This contrast of learning styles led to disagreements between us. Some of the disagreements we could resolve verbally, but others could only be resolved physically as we danced. One memorable February evening after dance class, Anita was driving me home, and we were verbally working out the steps for the chase turns in the cha-cha. We had reached an impasse in the process and could only settle things physically. What followed is perhaps one of the strangest scenes in the annals of ballroom dancing. Anita stopped the car, and we stepped out onto the cold, icy street. We met in the center of the road. Our eyes locked, and we squared off against each other. I took her hand in mine and placed my right hand midway down her back. She placed her left hand atop my shoulder, and we danced in the middle of the deserted street in our ski jackets. The street light was our spotlight, and the road our dance floor. Oblivious to the cold, we worked out the steps together in our different ways. Anita counted out the steps in her methodical manner, while I intuitively felt my way towards perfection. I would never have imagined myself dancing on the frozen, forbidding winter streets of Edmonton, but I had found my partner, and that's what we did. We danced. That story came to us from Mark Cross of Edmonton, Alberta. We're going to get Serena Ryder back to do a couple of songs now.
Would you mind if I pretended we were somewhere else, doing something we wanted to? 'Cause all this living makes me wanna do is die, 'cause I can't live with you, and you don't even care. Would you mind if I pretended I was someone else, with courage in love and war? I used to think that's what I was, but now this lying hurts too much, and I don't know what for. Kissed your face in front of all of your friends. Would you mind if I got drunk and said I wanna take you home to bed? Oh, would you change your mind?
Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'm just actually working on a new record, and this is one of the new songs that's going to be on it. It's called Blown Like the Wind at Night. I hope you like it. It goes like this. Let's get drunk and let's pretend we are not slaves to anything or anyone who tells us how to be. We're simply witness to the war, participating on the living room floor and eating up our television dreams. I hope to God you haven't seen the last part of Best of Me, or tell me this is gonna be alright. Blown like the wind at night, but I ain't shaken, stone blind, water eyes, patience. I told you twice, have you no fears, have you no eyes? If this is love, what is hate? Do you understand my fate? Oh, I'm not broken, you can't fix me. Wish I had a man to miss me. Tell me everything will be alright.
Serena Ryder, she'll be back. Beginnings are always the hardest. A writer beginning a story is like a butterfly in a garden, sometimes starting with a rush, flitting from leaf to leaf, barely landing here before he flutters there. Other times, frozen, a pen hovering over the page without one single idea. The little butterfly of the mind overwhelmed by the confusion of possibility. Until, unbidden, the warm wind of inspiration begins to blow and the little wings begin to pump so faintly you don't notice at first. And then you catch the movement out of the corner of your eye. You see something moving that you thought was a plant. But then you make out the orange-black beauty of wing as clear as day. And even though they're moving ever so slowly and slightly, even though the butterfly's still on the stalk, you know that at any moment he's going to lift off and the story will begin. This story began the Saturday morning Dave's shoelace broke. Began like this. Dave and Morley were on their way to the market. The idea was to go early and get back before Sam woke up. The idea was fresh blueberry pancakes for breakfast. They were running late, of course, Morley at least 3 steps ahead of Dave. And he could feel her frustration beginning to simmer. He was hurrying to catch up. He was trying to make it to the door before the simmer became a boil. He thought he was ready, but of course he wasn't close to ready. He had to run upstairs for his wallet, and then after he'd done that, he couldn't find the car keys anywhere. He looked at Morley and grinned painfully. He said, I'm sure I left them here. He was pointing at the basket by the back door. Of course, he hadn't left them in the basket by the back door. Anyone could see that. And if you knew him, you could tell by the way he said, I'm sure I left them here, that he wasn't sure at all. That he didn't have a clue where he'd left them. The keys, it turned out, were upstairs in the laundry basket. In the pocket of jeans he was wearing on Thursday, which is the last time he drove the car. That took about 5 more minutes to work out. Morley waiting by the door through all this, through the discovery that they were missing and the searching and the working out, waiting still when he came down the stairs for the 3rd time with the keys in his triumphant little hand. I have no idea what they were doing there, he said, genuinely mystified. And then he stepped into his sneakers and he sat on the stairs to do them up. Go on, he said, as if she hadn't been waiting since this began. I'll be right out, he said. And that's when he pulled the laces tight, and that's when the left lace snapped. And that is the exact moment this story began. That moment by the back door when Dave's shoelace broke, and Dave said, just a minute, and he ran to the basement, and he grabbed the very first thing that he saw down there that had laces, which happened to be a pair of skates. And he ripped the long waxed lace out of one of the skates and he stuffed it in his pocket and he tripped out to the car, 1 shoe half on and half off. When they got to the market, Dave headed for the little cafe by the entrance, the one on the right with the sandwiches. I'll catch up, he said. And he sat there and he threaded the hockey lace into his sneaker. When he was finished, there was a lot of lace left over. So he did a double knot and he stuffed the leftover lace into the shoe and he was good to go. Sam was awake when they got home, but it was Saturday and he was watching television, not even close to feeding himself. So technically they made it in time and they had pancakes for lunch and no harm was done. 2 weeks went by. It was a Friday, twilight. That sweet moment of indifference between day and night. Dave and Morley and Sam, sitting in the back seat, were in the sweetest place you can be for that great gray cosmic sigh. They were on the road, in between here and there, trying to decide where they were going to pull off the highway for the night. I don't care, said Sam, as long as it has a pool. They were in upstate New York on a spur-of-the-moment road trip. They had dipped across the border just because it seemed like fun, just because it was like the old days. They had nowhere to be except for Sunday evening. On the way home, they were going to stop to have dinner with their daughter Stephanie and her boyfriend Tommy. Up ahead on the outskirts of one of those little highway towns that you never heard of, there was a motel with a vacancy sign all lit up, blue and green neon flickering against a purple sky. Sam looked up from the back seat and read the sign and gasped. And then he began to read it out loud. "Look," he said, "Indoor and Morley." Cut him off and finished his sentence for him. "Pool," she said. "It means pool, indoor pool. The L has burned out." Sam said, "Can we take a picture?" The Totem Motor Inn, indoor pool. Dave pulled in. Before long, Morley was settling onto the chaise lounge on their second floor balcony. She was reading Lullabies for Little Criminals. Sam flounced onto the bed with a TV remote. "Sweet," he said, "satellite." "Come on," said Dave. 5 minutes later, Dave and Sam were heading for the pool. There was already a kid in the water. He was older than Sam, but he was acting a lot younger. He was loud and splashy. He was obnoxious. Moment Dave walked into the room, the kid got out of the water and ran across the pool deck and jumped back into the water right in front of Dave. Cannonball. "Hey," said Dave, jumping back. Too late, he was already soaked. The kid ruined their swim. And Sam took off. Dave lingered behind and waited for Sam to get out of earshot. And soon as he was, he walked over to the kid, leaned over and said, "You know what?" He said, "You are old enough to know better." Next morning, Dave woke up first. He lay in bed for a while, but Morley wasn't stirring. After a few minutes, he propped himself up on an elbow and whispered in his sleeping wife's ear. He said, "I'm going to go have a walkabout. I'll bring you a coffee." Morley mumbled, "Don't hurry." And she rolled over and went back to sleep. Dave pulled on the pants and T-shirt he was wearing the night before and padded to the door. He hung the "Do Not Disturb" sign on the handle, and he closed it softly behind him. He took the stairs down rather than the elevator. And when he got to the lobby, saw a girl behind the desk wearing a brown tunic. "Morning," she said, cheery Saturday smile. She pointed down the hall. "Complimentary coffee in the Crockett room." Dave set off past the elevators and the rack with the brochures, past the dark bar where he and Morley had had a beer by the fireplace the night before, past the pool, and there was the Crockett room, a right turn after the fitness center. He had to use his room key to open the fitness center door. He went in backwards, pushing the door with his hip, coffee in one hand and a surprisingly delicious cinnamon bun in the other. Room was bigger than you would have expected, small nonetheless, a couple of Nautilus machines, a rowing machine, and one of those, whatever you call them, running machines. Dave had never tried one. And he wasn't about to now. Except it was early, and no one else was around. So he climbed tentatively up onto the black treadmill. That's what you call them, treadmills. He balanced his coffee on the arm of the machine. There was an LED control panel with a daunting number of choices: age, weight, aerobic, anaerobic, fitness level. What did that mean? They make these things unnecessarily complicated, thought Dave. They should just have on and off. Dave took a sip of his coffee and stared at the screen. Personalized program. Now that was promising. He reached out and pressed personalized program. And a voice said, "Good morning, Brandon." And then the belt he was standing on lurched, and what was left of his coffee flew out of his hand and splashed onto the control panel. And then the voice, which Dave now realized was coming out of the machine, was saying, in 10, it was saying in 9, 8, 7. Little too much was happening at once. And it was all happening a little too quickly. The treadmill was speeding up and making Dave walk a little faster than was comfortable. And he was puffing a bit and scanning the control panel as he puffed. He was looking for the off button. There must be an off button. When suddenly there was a bang and, hey, someone had grabbed Dave's left foot. He lurched forward, almost falling, regaining his balance at the last moment. Hey, said Dave for the second time. He's hopping along the treadmill on his right foot now, pulling with the left, but his left foot won't come, and it's not because someone's grabbed it. It's because both ends of that overlong hockey lace were disappearing into the bowels of the machine. Dave's shoelace was wrapping itself around the treadmill rollers, and he couldn't pull it loose. He was trapped. And then the voice from the machine was saying, in 3, 2, 1, and there was a flourish of trumpets. Maybe it was the theme from Rocky, and the treadmill began to rise up in the air. Dave was running uphill now, hopping. Actually, his heart pounding, his leg pumping, his mind racing. Just who was this Brandon? And why on earth would he choose to do this to himself? And then Dave felt a wave of relief. There was a stop button. It was right in front of him, as plain as day. He smiled and he reached out and he pressed it, and nothing happened. Which is what happens when you soak a solid-state circuit board in coffee. But Dave didn't know that. And that's not all he didn't know. He didn't know, for instance, that the mysterious Brandon, who had carelessly left his computer chip in training preferences, was training for the Boston Marathon. And that Dave was about to re-experience Brandon's last training session. A simulated 23-kilometer run through the Adirondack Mountains. All Dave knew was that he was literally running for his life. He was running the Boston Marathon with his left foot in a leg hold trap. And as he hopped along, he was staring right at a big poster on the wall in front of him. Start out slowly, said the poster. Talk to your doctor before exercising. Dave pounded along for 12 long minutes until he couldn't pound anymore, and then he managed to hop his right foot onto the side platform. He had to leave his left foot behind. And he stood there on the side of this machine, his free foot on the platform on the side, and his trapped foot flipping and flopping like Brian Mulroney with a bag full of money. Desperate times. And desperate times require desperate measures. So Dave began to bend over slowly. He bent down until he was almost squatting. And he stared at that treadmill going round and around, and he reached out with both his hands, and he grabbed it. He actually managed to stop it for an instant. Then there was a bang, and he was catapulted back onto the belt. Sadly, he was facing the wrong way. He was running backwards now, up an Adirondack Mountain faster than he'd ever run forwards in his life. And then the voice on the machine said, "Let's take it up a notch, Brandon." And that is when the fitness room door opened. in the name of God, croaked Dave. Help me. And then he looked over his shoulder to see who had come in. And he looked right into the eyes of the kid from the swimming pool. The plug, gasped Dave. Pull the plug. And the kid from the swimming pool walked right over to him. And he looked right into his eyes and he said, you know what? You are old enough to know better. And he turned around and he walked right out of the room. Dave kept hopping for another 10 minutes. And during those 10 minutes, he made his peace with God and the fates. He should have guessed he was going to die like this. At any moment, he was going to fall over from exhaustion. Not quite the dignified exit he had imagined. Probably his whole body would get sucked into the roller. Probably he'd get flattened like some sort of cartoon character. That's what he was thinking anyway when the fitness room door opened again. And someone said, hey man, I think I left my chip in your machine. Dave tried to summon up as much dignity as he could. Whatever, said Dave. I was just finishing. It's all yours. And Brendan, maybe 25, 27, certainly not 30, walked across the room and he reached out and he flipped up a plastic cover and he removed his chip and the machine stopped abruptly, just like that. Unfortunately, Dave kept running. It was barely 9:30 when he limped back into his bedroom. Morley was sitting on the bed. She was surrounded by tourist brochures. She looked up when she saw him and smiled and said, hey, did you know we're in the Adirondacks? There's some wonderful hikes around here. I was thinking we could have breakfast and go for a hike. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank our special musical guest, Serena Ryder. Thanks also to Bill Herault, Brad Scrutton, Frank Finistori, and Ron Skinner for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean in Keswick, Ontario. I know. We're going to get Serena Ryder to play one more song. So long for now.
If you're in Arizona, I'll follow you. If you're in Minnesota, I'll be there too. You'll have a million chances to start anew. Because my love is endless for you. Lonely as as a sailboat that's lost at sea. I'm lonely as a human could ever be. Together we were happy. Oh, how we're sad. This loneliness is driving me mad.
Serena Ryder. Thank you. Go home to your families.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.